Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 221. It's Monday, July 23rd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get right to it with some Toledo news. This from the American Fitness Index. This is the 2023 rankings. Fitness rankings of the top 100 cities in America. Drum roll, please. Where does Toledo come out of the top 100? 84. Wah, 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 wah. Well, that's probably not too surprising from data I've seen before, but it's still a little disappointing. There's two subscales in this, different collections of health indices or metrics within that, and there's a huge disparity. So the personal health rank, we were ranked 99th out of 100. Not good. But on the community environment rank, we actually were 30th. There's a very respectable showing. And that relates to the built environment, recreational facilities and parks, policy and funding issues. So actually the community-wide metrics are actually better, but the personal health rankings, which of course have to do with, are related to social determinants as well. But so that 99th ranking is actually driven by the fact that of the 100 cities, we're ranked 95th in diabetes prevalence, 93rd in asthma prevalence, and 92nd in obesity prevalence. So an 84th ranking out of 100 in the American Fitness Index of the top 100 cities in America. We can do better. Let's go for most improved. Okay, well, for you fitness buffs out there, this may be a cautionary story for you. This from USA Today. What's in your sports supplement? Not what's on the label, study finds. Sports supplements may not contain what their bottle says they do, and they might include unapproved drugs instead, according to a new study. The study examined 57 products claiming to include botanicals that improve sports performance. Only 6 of the supplements, just 11%, included roughly what the label promised they would. Meanwhile, 7 included drugs explicitly prohibited by the Food and Drug Administration. 40% had no detectable amount of the ingredient they were supposed to contain. Let me read that again. For sports supplements tested, 40% had no detectable amount of the ingredient they were supposed to contain. Yikes. Those that did have the advertised ingredient didn't always have the right amount of it. Concentrations ranged from almost none to more than 3 times the amount listed on the label. Industry is reckless with consumer health, said Dr. Pieter Cohen, an internist at the Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School, who helped lead the new research. Supplements can cause side effects and contain contaminants like heavy metals. One study blamed more than 20,000 emergency room visits a year on supplement side effects. The general public often doesn't realize that the supplement they see on their grocery store shelf hasn't been reviewed by the FDA for effectiveness. People believe the FDA does more than it does, said Lurie, the president and executive director of the Center for Science and Public Interest, a nonprofit consumer advocacy group, and supplements can cause injury to the wallet. Cohen said he's long been concerned about sports supplements. About 10 years ago, after the FDA banned the use of the stimulant ephedra, he found other potentially dangerous stimulants still present in supplements. He alerted the FDA, which sent out warning letters to manufacturers, but never followed through, Cohen said. Industry has done nothing to clean up their act, and the FDA has done nothing to enforce the law, he said. And the law is completely inadequate to prevent these products from coming on shelves in the first place. At a minimum, Lurie said, the government should require companies to disclose what products they make. Right now, it's impossible for the FDA to prioritize its limited inspection resources because it knows the names of companies, but not whether they sell supplements that need extra vigilance. Some products are more likely to be sold to children, prone to heavy metal contamination, or commonly tainted with pharmaceuticals, so those should be inspected more often, Lurie said. Given these findings, clinicians should advise consumers that supplements listing botanical ingredients with purported stimulant or anabolic effects may not be accurately labeled and may contain FDA-prohibitive drugs, the study concludes. If you're buying supplements, Cohen recommends choosing those certified by either the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, symbolized with the initial USP in an oval inside a circle, or the NSF with the initials in a blue circle. This certification doesn't mean that ingredients are going to help you in your workout, Cohen said, but it provides some assurance that you're getting what's on the label. Only two ingredients have been shown to marginally improve workouts in the short term, Cohen said. Creatine, an amino acid, can support muscles and help with repetitive lifting, he said. And a small amount of caffeine, about 1,000 milligrams or as much as a small cup of coffee, can improve function if you're tired, he said, although the benefit is subtle. So this chaotic reality is the case for basically all supplements, you know, vitamin mineral supplements as well as athletic or sports performance supplements. The FDA doesn't have much regulations, doesn't even really have good requirements about what's in it, let alone anything about the efficacy of a particular product that's sold as a supplement. Okay, well, let's switch gears a lot and go much bigger. Let's talk about gun safety. This from Scientific American. The Supreme Court should back firearms restraints that save lives. At my county coroner's office, I regularly review cases of murdered women. They are victims of domestic violence, overwhelmingly one shot to death by ex-husbands, ex-boyfriends, and other men they knew. The Supreme Court is now poised to decide whether to put guns more easily into the hands of these abusers turned murderers, which would enshrine domestic violence as a warped historical privilege of the U.S. Constitution. Or the court can make life-saving and legally sound decisions and protect people such as the murder's victims, mothers, daughters, and children that I see in these case files. In February, a federal circuit court in Texas ruled in U.S. v. Rahimi that a person under an active domestic violence civil protection order is nevertheless constitutionally entitled to possess firearms. In its upcoming term, the U.S. Supreme Court will decide the constitutionality of this Fifth Circuit decision, which now is the law in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. I direct the University of California Irvine School of Law Domestic Violence Clinic and co-chair the Orange County Domestic Violence Death Review Team, which convenes in the county coroner's office. Almost all the deaths we examine are firearm deaths, and this team has firsthand knowledge of just how dangerous it would be to strike down nearly 30 years of federal law under the Violence Against Women Act, prohibiting individuals under a domestic violence protection order from possessing firearms. The majority of mass shootings are related to domestic violence and are caused by men with histories of committing domestic violence. Zaki Rahimi's actions described below show the need for the federal law's firearm restraints that protect abuse survivors, their children, and our communities. The Supreme Court should overturn the circuit court's breach of federal law to protect domestic violence survivors from being shot to death. What's troubling is that the Roberts Court's recent decision places a higher premium on guns than lives. Last year, in the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Incorporated versus Bruin, the court decided that gun laws must have a historical analogy to firearm regulations from the time of the Constitution's framing, rather than advancing an important and current government interest. The Texas Circuit Court then reasoned in Rahimi that because domestic violence existed in the 18th century and the framers of the Constitution did not restrict domestic abusers from having guns, current laws cannot prohibit firearm possession while an individual is subject to a domestic violence civil protection order. Instead, they contrast those laws with modern requirements of, quote, individualized findings of credible threats to identified potential victims before claiming that the old laws are not analogous enough to justify under their originalist thinking. So this is crazy that, you know, you use these, you know, the era of when the Constitution was established, and now you've got, we don't do restrictions based on the firearms that were available at that time by saying it's illegal to have anything but a single shot musket that takes 2 minutes to load, or a flint rock pistol that also isn't easy to load. But they're looking at the culture at that time and the fact that domestic violence was not adequately regulated or recognized or protected, and saying basically you can't do that now. Okay. The facts of the U.S. versus Rahimi case, meanwhile, are chilling. In 2020, after Zaki Rahimi, a drug dealer in Texas with a history of armed violence, assaulted his girlfriend and threatened to shoot her, she sought a civil protective order to protect herself and her child. Rahimi voluntarily agreed to this court order, which barred him from possessing firearms or ammunition during the order's duration. While under the order, he threatened multiple women with a gun and committed 5 public shootings in Texas, including shooting an AR-15 into the home of someone to whom he had sold drugs and firing bullets into the air in a fast food restaurant when his friend's credit card was declined. Rahimi pled guilty to unlawful firearm possession after a judge rejected his Second Amendment challenge. But the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision following the Supreme Court's Bruin opinion. The U.S. Supreme Court now has the opportunity to both contend with how domestic violence laws and firearm technology have rapidly evolved since the Constitution's framing, and recognize that adjudicated domestic abusers fit the category of classes of people to be disarmed as dangerous under federal law. Domestic violence has always existed, and it was condoned at the time of our nation's founding. As long as a husband did not kill or maim his wife, he could not be prosecuted. It wasn't until 1993 that every state had a civil protection order law against domestic violence. Unsurprisingly, the men drafting the Constitution in the 1700s did not specify domestic violence firearm restrictions. Thankfully, legal recognition of and remedies for domestic violence have evolved since then. My clients and domestic violence survivors throughout our nation deserve better than turning back time on protection from abuse and firearm fatalities. And of course, you have to look at the ridiculousness, because the Second Amendment talks about, you know, well-regulated militias. By the way, it's the only time that well-regulated appears in the Constitution is around firearms. And I'm not sure that domestic violence perpetrators should be considered a militia, but they should be well-regulated. Okay. When the Fifth Circuit's dubious logic insisted that a domestic violence ban on possession of firearms is an outlier that our ancestors would never have accepted, the court predictably failed to extend its reasoning to limiting firearm technology to what was available at the time of the drafting of the Second Amendment, Revolutionary-era muskets, and flintlock pistols. Guns are the cause of the majority of domestic violence homicides, and when an abusive partner has access to a gun, the risk of homicide to a female partner increases by 1,000%. Research shows that people who are violent in their relationships tend to have more guns, homicides tend to happen after a long history of domestic violence, and in 2/3 of cases, an abusive partner has used the gun in their home against the woman they are battering. Firearm restrictions against domestic abusers works. States that limit gun availability have fewer intimate partner killings. Given that the majority of mass shooters have known histories of domestic violence, upholding domestic violence firearm restrictions provides opportunities for intervention before widespread tragedy. The domestic violence firearm restriction at issue has made a life-saving difference to abuse survivors. The Rahimi decision, however, prioritizes the rights of violent people to own guns over the rights of their partners, children, and communities to be safe from killings. The Fifth Circuit's decision is dead wrong and dangerous. and the U.S. Supreme Court now should correct ambiguities from Bruin and appropriately restrain abusive individuals from possessing firearms. Lives depend on it. And I want to do a little postscript here, tying this into another seemingly unrelated issue, which is maternal mortality. So perinatal mortality, maternal mortality, is considered that which happens during pregnancy or within 1 year after birth. And one of the largest causes of perinatal mortality, which is that first year after birth particularly, but also during pregnancy, is domestic violence. So this particular Supreme Court ruling could actually affect maternal mortality and be particularly dangerous for women in some of the most vulnerable times in life, where I might add that having a child, carrying a child and having a child, can bring a lot of stress into a household and exacerbate domestic violence in many situations. Which, of course, many vulnerable women are most and disproportionately affected in a post-Roe world as well. Okay, well, sticking to a pregnancy-related story, this from MedPage Today, hepatitis C infections in pregnancy skyrocketed over the past two decades. The prevalence of hepatitis C virus infections in pregnant women increased 16-fold over a 21-year period, with associated higher risks of adverse perinatal outcomes. Overall, the data support the recommendations for universal hepatitis C virus screening with each pregnancy proposed by the CDC and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Perinatal care and delivery may be the initial healthcare exposure for many women. These touchpoints represent an opportunity for healthcare professionals to identify hepatitis C virus infection and link women and their children to appropriate specialist care. Injected drug use is a leading cause of factor for hepatitis C virus infection in adults. Because of the opioid epidemic, the number of cases of acute hepatitis C virus infection tripled from 2010 to 2015. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a series of healthcare-related stories, and as often the case, it's not very much good news. Let's start first up with stat news. Misdiagnoses cost the U.S. 800,000 deaths and serious disabilities every year, study finds. Diagnostic errors, that is, overlooking a disease or diagnosing it erroneously or late, are a known occurrence in healthcare and one that can have tragic effects. Yet so far, there have been few attempts to quantify misdiagnoses in terms of deaths and permanent disability, and the full scale of their impact has been underestimated by the medical community, according to a 2015 report by the National Academy of Medicine. A new study published in the British Medical Journal finally addresses that gap. An estimated 371,000 people die every year following a misdiagnosis, and another 424,000 are permanently disabled. A total of 800,000 people suffering serious harm, said David Newman Toker, the lead author of the paper and a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and director of its Center for Diagnostic Excellence. Settling on an exact number is hard because many cases of misdiagnosis go undetected, he said. It could be fewer than this study identified, or more, between 500,000 and 1 million. Though in any event, it would be the most common cause of death or disability due to medical malpractice. He likens the issue of misdiagnosis to an iceberg, saying cases leading to death and disability are but a small fraction of the problem. We focused here on the serious harms, but the number of diagnostic errors that happens out there in the U.S. each year is probably somewhere in the order of magnitude of 50 to 100 million, he said. If you actually look, you see it's happening all the time. But misdiagnoses typically don't lead to severe consequences, because most times people aren't visiting a doctor with a serious condition. The risk level just walking through the door in the doctor's office that something horrible is going to happen to you because of a diagnostic error is actually quite low, said Newman Toker. That's different, though, for the minority of people who walk into the doctor's office with serious, potentially fatal conditions. Say someone who feels dizzy because of the onset of a stroke, but is diagnosed with vertigo instead, or a young woman with breast cancer is missed during a routine checkup. For them, the study found the risk of death associated with misdiagnosis is 4%, and the risk of severe disability, 11%. Analyzing the nature of misdiagnoses also provides significant opportunities for solutions. The errors are many, but they are quite concentrated. According to the study, 15 diseases account for about half of the misdiagnoses, and 5 diseases alone, that is stroke, sepsis, pneumonia, venous thromboembolism, and lung cancer caused 300,000 serious harms, or almost 40% of the total, because clinicians failed to identify them in patients. That's a lot that you could accomplish if you cut those harms by 50% of just those five diseases. That would be 150,000 prevented serious permanent disabilities or death, he said. The overwhelming reason for misdiagnosis is cognitive error on the part of the doctor, he said. Doctors may make poor diagnostic decisions because the signs of the disease aren't typical, or because the symptoms are too common and not frequently associated with a severe disease. Dizziness, for instance, occurs in the majority of cases of stroke, but only very few cases of dizziness result in stroke. Or it may be an issue of bias, either circumstantial, for instance, overlooking the possibility that a young patient may be having a stroke because it's exceedingly rare, or systemic, resulting, for instance, in dismissal of symptoms reported by black patients. Newman Toker said his research estimates that being a woman or a person of color increases chances of misdiagnosis by 20 to 30%. This means that finding a way to avoid such cognitive errors, at least in the most commonly misdiagnosed severe diseases, would save a large number of lives. A quick way to do it? Routinely incorporating a second opinion in visits. I believe that the quickest way to solve the diagnostic error problem in the real world would be to construct approaches that basically rely on the, quote, phone a friend model, he said. This doesn't mean that the patient should have to seek a second opinion, but rather that providers should make it standard practice to consult with a colleague before providing a diagnosis or dismissing a patient. The study's findings also provide insight into the economic burden of misdiagnoses, something that so far has been hard to quantify due to the lack of reliable estimates of occurrence. To explain the huge costs of misdiagnoses, William Padula, an assistant professor of pharmaceutical and health economics at the University of Southern California, who did not participate in the study, also uses a missed stroke example. It is the most commonly misdiagnosed severe condition, so much so that AI is being tested as a solution. A patient comes into the emergency department with a headache or dizziness, and they'll get told to go away, and then they go home, and then a week later you find out they had a stroke, he said. By then, the stroke is compounded so much that what could have been addressed in the moment for $10,000 now becomes a $100,000 issue. So there's a margin of $90,000 that's been added to the U.S. health system because of the misdiagnosis. Multiply that for hundreds of thousands of misdiagnoses, and the total costs are exorbitant, on the order of $100 billion. And likely untold billions of dollars more, said Padula, especially considering societal costs such as years of lost productivity due to premature death or disability. On the one hand, we could be saving $100 or more billion by accurately diagnosing. And then on the back end, if we get this problem right, then instead of a $22 trillion GDP, we might have a $24 trillion GDP, just because everybody's getting the care that they need, he said. This helps put into perspective the costs that would be incurred to get a second opinion or to add extra tests to rule out certain conditions. It's a cost-effective solution upfront to spend the extra money to more accurately diagnose patients, said Padula. Yet the funding for research to improve diagnoses is extremely limited, proportional to, Toker said, the insufficient political and medical importance being given the issue. The amount of federal research dollar support that's going to address this problem is on the order of magnitude of $20 to $30 million a year, he said. Before 2016, the federal funding was even lower at $7 million a year, he said, but it was raised as more data came out on the impact of misdiagnoses. That amounts to about $50 per death, a pittance, he said, considering the federal investments made in researching treatments for some serious diseases, such as certain types of cancer, can run as high as $400,000 per every death recorded from the disease. Okay, need to get our house in order, do a little prioritizing. So misdiagnosis, a major problem, with some potential relatively straightforward solutions.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, sticking to the theme of dysfunctional American healthcare, I reported a lot on the deficiencies of Medicare Advantage plans and their particular profiteering and lower quality than traditional Medicare. But perhaps not surprisingly, that may be even worse in Medicaid, the public program for poorer folks. This from the New York Times. Insurers deny medical care for the poor at high rates, report says. Private health insurance companies paid by Medicaid denied millions of requests for care for low-income Americans with little oversight from federal and state authorities, according to a new report by U.S. investigators. Medicaid, the federal state health insurance program for the poor that covers nearly 87 million people, contracts with companies to reimburse hospitals and doctors for treatment and to manage an individual's medical care. About three-quarters of people enrolled in Medicaid receive health services through private companies, which are typically paid a fixed amount per patient rather than for each procedure or visit. The report by the Inspector General Office of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services details how often private insurance plans refuse to approve treatment and how states handle the denials, or more appropriately, didn't handle the denials. Doctors and hospitals have increasingly complained about what they consider to be endless paperwork and unjustified refusals of care by the insurers when they fail to authorize costly procedures or medicines. The companies that require prior authorization for certain types of medical services say these tools are aimed at curbing unnecessary or unproven treatments, but doctors claim it often interferes with making sure patients receive the services they need. The investigators also raised concerns about the payment structure that provide lump sums per patient. They worried it would encourage some insurers to maximize their profits by denying medical care and access to services for the poor. The report emphasized the crucial role that state and federal officials should play to ensure the denials were justified. People of color and people with lower incomes are at increased risk of receiving low-quality health care and experiencing poor health outcomes, which makes assuring access to care particularly critical for the Medicaid population, the investigators said. The concern over inappropriate denials is not limited to Medicaid. Last year, the same investigators examined denials among private Medicare Advantage plans and found that some of the care that was rejected may have, in fact, been medically necessary. While the current report did not look at whether the Medicaid denials were valid, the investigators emphasized the insurers were much more aggressive in refusing to authorize care under Medicaid than under Medicare, the federal program for the elderly and disabled. The companies denied one of eight requests in 2019, roughly two times the rate under Medicare Advantage, they said. Unlike with Medicare, if an insurer refuses to authorize a treatment, patients are not automatically provided with an outside medical opinion as part of their appeal. They are entitled to a state hearing. These differences in oversight and access to external medical reviews between the two programs raises concerns about health equity and access to care for Medicaid-managed care enrollees, the investigators said. Patients also complain that it's difficult to get care under these plans. Bree Moss of Dubuque, Iowa, has been diagnosed with diabetes since she was 12 years old. She's 34 now, so 22 years. But struggled to get her Medicaid plan to approve a doctor-recommended new insulin pump to help control her blood pressure, her blood sugar. It might be a game changer for me, said Ms. Moss, who added that her insurer initially would not cover it. Working with People's Action, a national advocacy network, and a sister organization, Ohio Citizens for Community Improvement, where she is a member, Ms. Moss eventually won an appeal to get the device covered. The investigators also found that state oversight of coverage denials was lax. Many states do not routinely examine the insurance denials nor collect information about how many times a plan denies requests for prior authorization. They do not make sure people can get another medical opinion if they want to appeal. The lack of review makes it challenging for federal and state officials to know if insurers are living up to their commitments to ensure coverage of medically necessary health care, according to the report. States are directly responsible for overseeing insurance providers of Medicaid coverage, but investigators urge the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to require more oversight. The denial rates recorded by the investigators varied widely by insurer and by state. The investigators looked at 115 managed care organizations in 37 states operated by seven multi-state insurers with the highest Medicaid enrollments, representing some 30 million people in 2019. They requested information about denials from the insurers and surveyed the states about their oversight role. Elevance, the for-profit insurer previously known as Anthem, had plans with denial rates that varied from 6 to 34%, while United Healthcare had plans that had rates ranging from 7 to 27% denials. Although any individual prior authorization denial may be appropriate, it is unclear why some medical care organizations or managed care organizations had rates of prior authorization denials that were so much higher than their peers, the investigators said. So that huge disparity tells you that there's not very good systems or oversight, and perhaps a smaller proportion are really abusing the system, of course, leading to very poor outcomes for many. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, sticking to the theme of dysfunctional American healthcare, here's another dysfunction that runs across American healthcare, but particularly among private health insurers: administrative burden. This from the New York Times. The overlooked reason our healthcare system crushes patients. This story is a result of the space between the care that providers want to give and the care that patients actually receive. That space is full of barriers, tasks, paperwork, bureaucracy. Each is a point where someone can say no. This can be called the administrative burden of healthcare. It's composed of work that is almost always boring, but sometimes causes tremendous and unnecessary human suffering. The administrative burden includes many of the chores that we all hate: calling doctor's offices, lining up referrals, waiting in the emergency room, sorting out bills from a recent surgery, checking up prescription refills. There's a general sense that all that unpaid labor required to get medical care is increasing. This is in part because as healthcare costs spiral upward, health plans have tried to find incentives to steer treatment to reduce costs. These incentives can be a crucial part of managing costs in a country that spends about twice as much on healthcare as a percent of its economy as other high-income countries. Creating administrative burden is a time-honored tactic for insurance companies. When you're trying to incentivize things and you don't want to push up the dollar cost, you can push up the time cost, said Andrew Friedson, the director of health economics at the Milken Institute. Administrative burden can work as a technique to keep costs down. However, part of the problem is that we don't count the burden to patients, and so it doesn't factor into policy decisions. There's nobody measuring the time spent on the phone, plus lost wages, plus complications from delayed care for every single patient in the United States. A recent study co-written by Michael Ann Kyle, a research fellow at Harvard Medical School, found that about a quarter of insured adults reported their care was delayed or missed entirely because of administrative tasks. This burden falls most heavily on those who can least afford it: vulnerable people like cancer patients, those with complex medical conditions, or those with a chronically ill child. I've observed that this burden splits along racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines. These tasks are more difficult for those who have hourly jobs, who don't speak English as their first language, or who can't read complex documents easily. For many Medicaid patients, even just getting or staying enrolled on their insurance coverage can create hours of extra work that delay care. For some patients, such delays will lead to serious consequences and increased costs for the entire system. That's clearly not the way to save money. There are some simple solutions, such as simplifying the paperwork that healthcare requires. For example, requiring all companies to use a universal form for medication approvals. One of the first steps to any comprehensive solution would be a true accounting of the costs of administrative burden. Maybe we in the medical system do have to start counting up the hours patients and providers spend on the phone, in waiting rooms, and filling out forms. That would be difficult. It's not a metric the healthcare industry is used to evaluating, but it's not harder than doing the work itself, as patients do. And of course, one answer to this, a big answer that would solve this and many other problems, is having a single-payer healthcare system, so you don't have thousands and thousands of different regulations governing payments and authorization and all that. This could be part of a system where everybody's in and nobody's out. And politically, all being in the same boat might be a healthy thing.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, yet another story that shows how healthcare profiteering distorts good outcomes for the American people as a whole. This from Medical Express. Cancer experts call for cancer care to be centered on patients rather than commercial interests. Commercial rather than patient interests often drive cancer care and research, and patients deserve better, argue a group of global oncologists and patient advocates in a comment published in Lancet Oncology. The authors also established core guidelines for the development of a new patient-centered movement in cancer care, Common Sense Oncology. The comment says that there has been a shift over the past few decades from predominantly publicly funded clinical trials designed to answer questions important to patients to industry-funded trials, which aim to achieve regulatory approval or commercial advantage. The authors claim industry's control of the research agenda has created a system that is predominantly focused on new cancer medicines at the expense of investigating new approaches to surgery, radiotherapy, palliative care, and prevention. The comment also highlights how a substantial proportion of industry revenue is used for marketing campaigns aimed at influencing patients, policymakers, and oncologists, irrespective of clinical need. Professor Christopher Booth, Queen's University of Kingston, Canada, says, "While many cancer treatments make a real difference in the lives of our patients, there are growing concerns that some new treatments do not help patients live longer or feel better. Common Sense Oncology is a global initiative that prioritizes people over profits and promotes shared decision-making with patients. Our vision is that patients have access to cancer treatments that provide meaningful improvements in outcomes that matter, irrespective of where they live." People over profits. Amen to that. Okay, well, next up on a regulatory front where there's modest progress being made, this from The Hill. Just more than a third of hospitals are complying with price transparency rules. More than 2 years after federal hospital price transparency rules went into effect, only about a third of hospitals are currently in compliance, according to a new report. The nonprofit Patient Rights Advocate released its fifth semi-annual report, which found that only 36% of 2,000 surveyed hospitals were in complete compliance with the rule. Since January 1, 2021, hospitals have been required to give clear, accessible pricing information on their products and services, either through an online file or a consumer-friendly display of shoppable services. The Patient Rights Advocate report specifically found that while most hospitals have posted files about their prices, 64% of them had files that were incomplete or listed prices that were not clearly associated with both payer and plan. Another 3.5% did not post usable files on their charges. While less than half of all hospitals were found to be in complete compliance, that is still actually higher than the 25% compliance rate that was reported in February. So, It's moved up from 25 to 36% compliance. Continued noncompliance impedes the ability of employer and union purchasers, patients, and technology developers to analyze and compare prices. The patient rights advocate also examined the enforcement of penalties. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is in charge of enforcing compliance. And as the patient rights advocate noted, two hospitals that were previously penalized monetarily came into compliance soon after. Yet, in April of 2023, only two more hospitals were fined. Both were still found to be non-compliant in this review. At the time of this report, a total of four hospitals have been penalized. 0.2% of the hospitals that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services recognize as non-compliant. Clearly, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is not strongly enforcing this rule. So 2 years later, barely a third of complete compliance. Okay, well, I want to close the regular reporting of this episode with two quick stories on COVID. First up from the New York Times, a positive COVID milestone. The United States has reached a milestone in the long struggle against COVID. The total number of Americans dying each day from any cause is no longer historically abnormal. Excess deaths, as the number is known, has been an important measure of COVID's true toll because it does not depend on the murky attribution of deaths to a specific cause. Even if COVID is being underdiagnosed, the excess death statistic can capture its effects. The statistic also captures COVID's indirect effects, like the surge in vehicle crashes, gun deaths, and deaths from missed medical treatments during the pandemic. During COVID's worst phases, the total number of Americans dying each day was more than 30% higher than normal, a shocking increase. For long stretches of the past 3 years, the excess was above 10%. But during the past few months, excess deaths have fallen almost to zero, according to three different measures. COVID's toll, to be clear, has not fallen to zero. The CDC's main COVID webpage estimates that about 80 people per day have been dying from the virus in recent weeks, which is equal to about 1% of overall daily deaths. So this is the first time, the first summer that we've had that appears somewhat normal. Although I might point out that the projections for the winter are still talking about COVID being multiples of times worse than a typical flu season. So it's still around, still wreaking havoc, but it looks like the summer is the best that we've had since the pandemic began. And while there's small increases in COVID, hopefully that'll hold off until the fall for the regular, quote, flu season. Okay, and lastly, also on COVID, this from The Economist, a clue to China's true COVID-19 death toll. So I reported in earlier episodes, they were estimating that about 1.6 million folks in China died from their basically zeroing out their zero COVID policy. But China has not been forthcoming as far as reporting deaths. They use an extremely narrow definition for a COVID death. So this from The Economist. On July 13th, the authorities in Zhejiang, a rich coastal province, released what they probably thought was innocuous data about cremations in the first quarter of 2023. Around 171,000 took place during that time, up by 73% compared to the same period last year. The jump was undoubtedly caused by a wave of COVID-19. The central government lifted all COVID controls in December 2022. Just under 5% of China's population age 65 or older lives in Zhejiang. If one assumes that its share of COVID deaths is similar, that the disease mainly kills the old, a simple extrapolation suggests that there were 1.6 million excess deaths across China in the first quarter of this year, which is roughly in line with our modeled estimate of the country's COVID death toll. The central government, though, has acknowledged fewer than 84,000 deaths from COVID on the mainland since early December. Mainland. The data from Zhejiang was quickly removed from the internet. So, while China has not been forthcoming, there are other ways to do estimates, and it looks like the modeling that was done based on a lot of other information of 1.6 million turned out to be probably pretty true, as confirmed by the cremation data. A good way to measure deaths when the specific deaths and cause of deaths, particularly with COVID, are not being reported by the Chinese government. So, where there's not good information, conspiracies thrive. So this message. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, now for our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. First up, headers linked to memory issues, raising questions about soccer safety at the World Cup as the World Cup kicks off. So when you're in soccer or football, as it's known around most places in the world, doing headshots and hitting the ball with your head is linked to dementia and memory issues. So for all of us, don't hit your head against things if you can avoid it. And bonus article two gives us a little look back. Trump COVID shot ad boosted vaccination in red counties. And the fascinating thing is that this was very effective and cost about $115 per life saved. So, hey, sometimes you have to, you may not really like the messenger, but for the people that do, it makes a huge difference. Bonus article three, World Health Organization urges governments to set up surveillance for people at risk from heat waves. So, of course, surveillance, basically measuring things in real time and over time, is something that's a core function of public health. And heat waves were really doing some catch up, particularly with climate change rolling on. Is we don't have like red or purple or green, metrics, measurements for heat waves. We don't have warnings that are easily understandable to the population as a whole. And also, just public health needs to do better surveillance because we know who's at high risk and have a system whereby we can keep an eye on them and get services and prevent problems before they happen when heat waves do hit. Bonus article four, why ultra-processed foods matter. They worsen the state of world hunger. So as ultra-processed foods are moving into places around the world with more traditional diets, it's making world hunger and world nutrition worse. Bonus article five, very interesting article. I recommend it as one of the longer reads, what happened when Oregon decriminalized hard drugs? So, long story short, it's complicated, but it hasn't worked as well as people want, and mostly that's related to the fact that while they focused on harm reduction, which is good, they completely cut out law enforcement involvement, which was the only mechanism by which people that were addicts were actually interfacing with systems that might steer them towards treatment. And by taking that out, it's lost a lot of opportunity. Now, that law was actually based on program in Portugal, but in Portugal, they actually had, when somebody, you know, they wouldn't be prosecuted for the drug possession, but they would be evaluated for their drug use, and if they needed services, they would be referred, and that worked a lot better. Bonus Article 6, somewhat related, the painful legacy of law and order treatment of addiction in jail. So, like I said, having law enforcement funneling people into addiction treatment can be helpful, but the fact that it's so tied with so much punishment and incarceration, it's not a great place for people to heal. Bonus Article 7, providers still hesitate to prescribe buprenorphine for addiction despite X waiver removal. So the X waiver basically means that physicians don't need any additional training to prescribe buprenorphine for opioid addiction. And this is just one, it's very complicated, but there's a lot of reasons why providers, some good, some bad, for not prescribing buprenorphine. So one more thing to deal with the opioid epidemic. Bonus Article 8. Medical debt is making Americans angry. Doctors and hospitals ignore this at their peril. Another example of the fact that healthcare in America impoverishes and bankrupts people. Bonus Article 9. Medicare Advantage could get up to $1.6 trillion more than it's entitled to over the next decade due to coding oddities and healthier patients, and that could hurt the Medicare Trust Fund. So while our healthcare impoverishes people, it enriches healthcare, private healthcare companies. Bonus Article 10. A program to bring internet access to low-income people is running out of money. Healthcare will suffer. So this is at like $30 subsidy that lower-income people have had available to them. They expect it to run out sometime next year, and this might cut off internet connections or good quality internet connections and telehealth. So healthcare can suffer. Bonus Article 11, healthcare providers are raking in profits by exploiting programs meant for the poor. So this is a multi-billion dollar program that's supposed to make sure that pharmaceuticals get at a reasonable price to people that can't afford them, but it's being ripped off and exploited by the healthcare profiteers. And bonus Article 12, policy primer, the problems with Medicare Advantage. I've reported a lot on this, but this is a good just couple pages that give you a lot of bullet points of the problems with Medicare Advantage. If you're thinking about taking up one of those plans, please research it first. I would recommend against it. Bonus Article 13, in some states, gender dysphoria is a protected disability, and the momentum could be growing. So this is a good movement. Activists have been trying over the years to get the American Disability Act to include gender dysphoria. So, of course, this isn't protection specifically. It's not like being trans is a disability, but the experience of gender dysphoria is a protected disability in some states, and that momentum is growing. Bonus Article 14, FTC and Health and Human Services warn hospital systems and telehealth providers about privacy and security risks from online tracking technologies. So if you go to the websites, there's a lot of like Facebook and Google trackers that can actually get a lot of sensitive health information. And another healthcare privacy story, bonus Article 15, Biden's HIPAA expansion for abortion draws criticism and lawsuit threats. So the Biden administration is trying to bring abortion specifically under HIPAA protections so that folks that are seeking abortion healthcare services do not have their privacy violated by others, including law enforcement. Bonus Article 16, blue state doctors launch abortion pill pipeline into states with bans. So there's a number of states that have specifically protected people in their state from other state laws that are seeking to criminalize abortion health care. And so it's fostering these pipelines in this country. It's happened getting pills from outside this country, but this is kind of bringing it back home. Bonus Article 17, C-section rates are way too high. We need to hold doctors and hospitals accountable. So C-section rates are almost double what they probably should be, and it's over three times more dangerous than a vaginal delivery. And unfortunately, people who've had one C-section often are kind of expected to get another one, even though that's not necessarily required. Bonus Article 18, nudges from electronic health records could improve the implementation of tobacco use treatment almost threefold over standard care for cancer patients. So that's basically just a reminder in the health record can get cancer patients to get into tobacco use treatment. And maybe surprisingly, the majority of cancer patients who smoked prior to their diagnosis continue to smoke after their diagnosis. Bonus Article 19, America's Food Program for the Poor should focus on nutrition. So this is the battle of over whether SNAP should cover sugary drinks. I would say that's reasonable, but the argument how far to go is a good question. Bonus Article 20, undue influence. Anonymous donations to World Health Organization's new foundation raises concerns. Over the 2 years, 40% of their donations have been anonymous. For such a public organization, this should not be the case. While there's some reasons for anonymity, in order to have public trust, you should not have potential conflicts of interest hiding under anonymity. Bonus Article 21, top DEA official resigns after report on high-priced consulting work for pharma. So this is a good example of investigative reporting, got somebody who really had conflicts of interest to get pushed out. Bonus Article 22, light pollution is fixable. Can researchers and policymakers work together to dim the lights? So we know that light pollution is a problem for both humans and animals. And there's a lot of agreement between researchers and policymakers, but we've been pretty slow to move on that. So if you're interested in that, bonus Article 22. Article 23, as climate clock ticks, U.S. government has been using credits for burning trash to look green. So this is kind of we're using kind of an accounting trick without actually saving the environment. Yikes, we don't have time for that. Bonus Article 24, climate change threatens U.S. nuclear strike capability through flooding and heat waves. So climate change, one more thing it can affect, nuclear strike capability. Bonus Article 25, Trinity nuclear test fallout reached 46 states, Canada, and Mexico, new studies find. So interest that with the Oppenheimer movie out. We know that that fallout has reached most of the United States and Canada and Mexico. Bonus Article 26 is a good primer. A meatless diet is better for you and the planet. I've talked a lot about this, but if you want a just good overview of that, that's a good one. Bonus Article 27, last but not least, being anxious or sad does not make you mentally ill. We easily pathologize bad feelings, but they are a normal, even healthy part of human experience. You can read this and other articles by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.